was very helpful to sit in this afternoon with all of you and listen to the questions and the answers. Seriously, I mean, particularly in my situation as a senior monk, I tend to get a bit tired of listening to myself. And I remember Ajahn Chah saying once that it was so nice to have visiting monks or have the opportunity to go someplace else and listen to someone else teach, because you get hungry for Dhamma. Oh, wait. I tend to use the Pali. Dhamma is the same as Dharma. You know? What I've seen in myself over the years and what I've noticed in many people who I've had the opportunity to speak with while teaching is that there tends to be a difficulty that we run up against, bump up against, repeatedly in our practice. Tends to come down to just a view, an idea of ourselves. We tend to be rather judgmental, unloving, uncaring about ourselves. Say in another way, we don't like ourselves very much. Now that, and being idealistic, we set the scene for a lot of conflict. Now, all of you have had ample time, a really unique situation. Uh-oh, have I disturbed anything? I'm sorry. To sit for an extended period of time and watch, pay attention, notice many things about yourselves that I'm sure weren't quite as clear before, or perhaps even unknown. And many of the questions this afternoon were about, I've got this, I understand this much. What about out there? I mean, there's pizza and ice cream and cops, right? Not necessarily in that order. So what happens? Now, the main virtue, the virtue that is seen as the most important, is patience. Patience with oneself. It's got to begin there. Patience and learning to accept ourselves for just as we are. And to begin to acknowledge the ideas, the rather rigid, narrow, static ideas that we have of ourselves, open up to them, acknowledge them, and allow them to go their own way. They will. When Ajahn Sumedho was a young monk, one of the things that we do in the forest monasteries is we have chores every day, and once a week we sweep the monasteries. And in the hot season, that's when all the leaves fall off the trees in Asia. And in the hot season, it's very hot, 110 or 120. And there's a lot of leaves, and everything's very dry. And so you sweep the leaves, and there's always a cloud of dust. And the dust sticks to you because you're perspiring, and you can imagine after a couple hours of sweeping leaves, you're positively grubby. Ajahn Sumedho used to really dislike doing it. Really dislike doing it. And the huts in the woods, in the forest monasteries, are situated in such a way that you have a degree of privacy. You usually can't see the person who lives in the hut next to you. And so you have an area of maybe, on an average, 50 feet by 150 feet, with the cottage, the little hut, maybe in the middle of it. And you would be responsible for that area. In other words, when it came to sweeping, you were to sweep that whole area, and then something else, go out and help and sweep in the center of the monastery, down the paths. Well, Ajahn Sumedho, instead of sweeping the whole area, he'd sweep just this narrow path, you know, down through this area that he was supposed to sweep. Just this narrow path, just wide enough for him to walk, see? So, and then go out and help when he needed to. And one day he was, you know, sweeping with a big bamboo broom. And Ajahn Chah came by and looked at him and said, "Sumedho, is sweeping leaves dukkha?" Now you're going out there, right? Is changing diapers, doing the washing up, driving car, talking with people, is that dukkha? All the many things that you'll have to do. Huh? It's easy to be dependent on a certain situation. And this is a lovely place. And you're supported in your endeavor. That's important, you know. But, you know, it's a kind of a crutch. And when you have crutches are useful things. If you have a broken leg or something like that, then to use a crutch, it's necessary. It helps you get around. But if you depend on the crutch, when you already have some strength, then that would be detrimental to your growth. Now, it doesn't mean that, I'm not saying that you should go out and, you know, go into the heaviest part of the big cities, you know, and meditate on street corners or something like that. No. To be careful what you do and how you do it, but to understand that this situation was unique, and that when you leave here, things are going to change. And that the moments that you've had will change. You can't expect it would be asking too much for you to feel that the tranquility, the moments of concentration and joy that came from that concentration was going to be an everyday occurrence. When you're back with your families, when you're back doing the things that you have to do. A woman came to Ajahn Sumedho a few years ago and was very unhappy and despairing because she had been practicing for a number of years. And she felt, you know, her practice, she just wasn't getting anywhere in her practice. Ajahn Sumedho asked, "Well, you know, what do you do? Do you practice daily? And she said, yes, I try to sit day and night, in the morning and in the evening. She said, I'm pretty consistent about that. I said, well, do you work? And she said, oh, yes, I work. Turned out that she's an executive for a multinational, a very demanding job, very demanding clients, a lot of telephones ringing all the time, very active life, very pressurized. Ajahn Smith said, well, you're asking too much. To expect the mind to be calm, clear, lucid, and concentrated in such a situation. There can be awareness even of chaos in the mind. Forgot what I was going to say. It's all right. When we when we're on our own or in a situation where there's just a few people that share our needs and our views about practice, what we found very helpful in England is to encourage people to sit together, to practice together. City groups, what we call societies, Buddhist societies. There's quite a number of them where the monks go and teach from time to time. And initially, when we were asked to go and teach at such places, we wondered if it was going to be very helpful for them. And we found over the years that they seemed to provide a very helpful and needed energy, where people can come together and share their sorrows and disappointments. So if you have an opportunity to meet with others, to sit with others, to practice with others, then to make the effort to do it. Watch out for the post-meditation retreat blues. And all of those ideas of what you think is supposed to happen. And how you think you should respond in those situations. We have, you have jobs to go back to. It's possible to be aware Why are you working? Meditation isn't just about sitting or walking in a special way. Meditation, that mindfulness, that attentiveness. A monk came to Ajahn Chah and complained, you know, we have so much work to do here. We have to haul water and sweep leaves and often help out with the construction work of buildings. This is no time to meditate. And Ajahn Chah said, do you have time to breathe? That's your meditation. And so learning to give yourself to what you're doing in a very attentive, wholehearted way. And be humble enough and gentle and caring enough with yourselves to be the beginner. And to be the beginner always. Willing to come back and just start all over. You know, those moments that you have and you suddenly wake up and you realize that it's been some moments or minutes or maybe hours since the last time you were aware. What do you do? How often do you respond by spending some time mentally beating yourselves up? You know, look at this. It's been 25 minutes since I've... The last time I, you know, watched my breath. Yeah. Now that aversion towards oneself just keeps the mind going, keeps it agitated. When you, there's that moment of awareness, just, start right there, start all over, establish mindfulness right there, then. And allow the past to go. Reestablish attentiveness with the intention to be mindful. Understanding that we're all learning, we're all developing this path. And sometimes we're going to forget. Fine. That's just part of it. I don't seem to be in the mood or whatever to talk very much tonight. Yeah. Or give a talk. Do you have any questions? help me out. Yes.
Feel real inspired. aspire to be patient. Could you say something inspirational?
Tomorrow? I'll answer your question. The inspiration comes tomorrow. No. Well, if you notice, if you pay attention, you begin to see that our impatience, if we look back to it, it's usually rooted in self-disparagement, lack of kindness or love for oneself. And so we cause ourselves unnecessary suffering through our impatience. And how we are towards ourselves, we relate with others in that same kind of intolerant, impatient way. And so learning to be kinder, more patient and forgiving, so that there's just a little bit less unhappiness in the world. How's that?
Pretty good.
You did something difficult when you went 9 years ago, a small group, five of you. It must have been very discouraging at times.
I almost committed suicide.
A couple of things about what helped you.
Well, I ordained because I was rather disenchanted with things, with life, with what I saw that the material world could offer. And ending up in London was the monk that I was traveling with, I left before Ajahn Sumedho actually and went home to visit my family. And we weren't sure that we were going to go back to England and stay with him. We weren't sure. It was likely, but it wasn't until I called Ajahn Sumedho from Toronto and asked him if I should bring anything with me to England. And he told me, we were just going to stop off and pay our respects and then go back to Thailand with Ajahn Cha. And Ajahn Sumedho told me to bring long johns. And I thought, ah. So when we arrived there, the other monk and myself used to ask or used to wonder what we did wrong in the past to deserve to be there, you see. Because we went from this wonderful, spacious, lovely forest monastery in northeast Thailand to a rather dilapidated townhouse in Hampstead in London, which is supposed to be in... Is anyone from London? Ah, yes. This rather posh, nice part of London. And all of us had a very difficult time the first year. Ajahn Sumedho said that it was his worst rains retreat, at the end of the rains retreat season that we had there. He said it was the worst one that he had ever experienced. Yeah, it was very claustrophobic. Everything was gray, the weather, the people, the food. So Ajahn Sumedho noticed, it got to a point where we generally were just so unhappy. And he noticed how just the environment influenced us. And it was so easy to be overwhelmed by that. And it was kind of, it was cold on March in London, you know, cold and damp, and what you wanted to do was kind of just wrap your robes around you by a fire and drink tea, you know. He said that one needed to put some energy into it. So he started to encourage very strongly getting up early and taking cold showers to begin with. Now, when he first suggested that, you can imagine what came to mind. I said, no way in am I going to do that. But he, of course, he was doing it, you know. And the way we lived, we behind the townhouse, there were four breeze block little rooms, which they euphemistically, and but I think very correctly, called cells. And the shower was at the end, and he would walk by us, by the cells where we were staying, the rest of us, and make, you know, walk in such a way that we knew we could hear him go by, and he'd go into the shower and come back out. All this at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. And then I wasn't responding to any of this. And he started encouraging me during the day, you know, you should do this. And I still wasn't. And then it started to be knocking on my door, Anando. And Ajahn Sumedho is the type of person that doesn't do things like that. You know, he usually just suggests. But I thought, well, you know, he's doing it. He's encouraging me. He wants me to do it. He's telling me to do it. I should respond. Now, it's very interesting. A cold shower at 3 a.m. There's one thing that I noticed. If you have any doubts whatsoever, any kind, you allow negativity to fill the mind, you don't take a shower. As it was, the first time I took a cold shower, I went in and out so quickly, I didn't even get wet. But so what happens is you learn to cut negativity. You simply don't allow it to fill the mind. And you have to generate just, you know, something really positive. Go and do that. Because, you know, it goes against everything that's right and proper. And so that was one of the things that kind of set a tone, a mood. And then we used to do quite strenuous yoga. All of us had done yoga for years. We used to do 15-minute headstands. And he used to keep the clock, you know, in front of him. I'm sure it was longer than 15 minutes sometimes, you know. And such physical, you know, very positive things. Things that you had to put a lot of physical energy into and couldn't allow the mind to go into negativity. And that generated just a positive attitude, a more positive attitude. And that was very, really very helpful. And then he started setting up a more formal, structured schedule for us. With group meditations, you know. Also in the afternoon, we had them, as a matter of course, in the morning and in the evening, but also in the afternoon. But it was actually that's where I first began to appreciate how physical activity like that, you know, doing it in a very precise and determined way, especially at that time of the morning. Followed you, had a beneficial effect through the rest of the day. Well, we have some more time before they bring in the popcorn and the movie screen.
Yes, I wonder about this physical activity during intensive retreats. I find myself that I used to do yoga also in the intensive retreat. And in this retreat, I dropped it after 3 weeks mm-hmm. or a month. And a friend of mine, he also found that the energy coming up from the yoga was somehow not beneficial in the intensive setting.
Mm. Could you say that? Yes, I could appreciate that. What you have to appreciate, however, what I was talking about in London certainly wasn't an intense. Well, it was intense in a way. But then that's where one has to trust your own judgment and wisdom and find out what's good for you. Yeah. And people often ask, well, how much sleep do I need? You know, should I try cutting down or can I sleep as much as I did before? And I'm sure all of you have had opportunity to experiment with sleep and also with food, and you find out if you eat too much what happens, or if you sleep too much how you feel, and same with exercise, because you're developing in such a situation very refined states of consciousness, so that the energy that arises from certain exercises or a lot of physical exercise would be disruptive. I mean, really, this is a do-it-yourself course. Yeah. The situation is just conducive. You have a framework, a supportive framework, but it's up to each one of us to do the practice. Yes.
I've always been curious about how the practice of begging, of receiving food from another person in the Theravada tradition works out in a Western context where it's not, seems like that's just not considered acceptable or else it falls away.
Well, what we found in West Sussex, around Chithurst, is over the 6 years that we've been there, 6-7 years now that we've been there, about 15 families have moved into the area because we're there. And so they're Buddhists, they're supporters of the monastery. And they invite monks, and when the nuns are there, nuns, to come to their homes to receive alms. It works. Well, we don't depend, fortunately, we don't depend on all our food that way, you see. Oh, we'd be dead. Long time ago. No. I walked for alms every single morning in London. And I think I got a bunch of flowers one day. For about a year, a bunch of flowers and I don't know what else. Some dirty looks and Hare Krishna and however, we did receive 130 acres of woodland, and that's how we ended up in West Sussex. Ajahn Chah, this was strange. Ajahn Chah seldom encouraged us or told us in this situation, told us to do things. He He would just suggest or indicate what he thought would be the right thing to do. But before he went back to Thailand, his first visit and a brief stay with us in London, he said, you should go on alms round every morning. And he mentioned that several times, you know. And it was strange because it was unlike him to do something like that. And the only time, the only period that we didn't is when we received this wonderful letter from the chief of police, the chief of the local police station, saying something like, according to laws, whatever the number was, of 1628, your walking for alms in the manner that you do may be breaking the law. Wonderful. And we, a friend of ours is a barrister, a lawyer, and we sent him the letter and also the rules concerning our conduct when we walk for alms. And because we don't ask for anything, we rarely talk at all, but we're not allowed to ask for anything, then that and a number of other things, that he considered that it wasn't begging, and that the people who made the law, obviously were not thinking of Buddhist monks when they wrote the law, so that he suggested that we just carry on until if it came up, you know, someone complained again and we would have to go to court, then he offered to represent us. But it never happened. Now, in Asia, when we go, for instance, in Thailand, we go out for alms. That's where we get most of our food. Certainly all of the staple. Now, the Thai people, for instance, I talk about them because I spent some time with them. Their view of what's happening is that the monks are coming to offer us the opportunity to give something to them. Now, we could see that the monks are going to get something from the lay people. Which one's right? We have been very well supported in Britain while we've been there. Yes. The base of support is very broad. People coming to the monastery bring things. Like every evening we have a meditation session and people come for that quite regularly, and they might bring a bag of groceries when they come, or if sometimes people send money and state specifically that it's for food.
Development of Buddhism in Europe. How come that London got chosen?
Well, there's been interest in Buddhism in Britain for a long time. The Pali Text Society. Pali is the scriptural language in Theravada Buddhism. And they translated almost all of the scriptures beginning the turn of the century, 1880. So there's been an active academic interest in Buddhism since that time. And in 1956, there was a charity formed called the English Sangha Trust. And some of their aims were to support and act as stewards for a monastic community with the view of establishing a monastic community in Britain. And they tried unsuccessfully until 1977. It was due mainly because the monks who had been there weren't very experienced as monks, newly ordained monks, and usually were on their own. And that's very, very difficult. Yes.
Can you talk about the value of ordaining?
It's a little bit easier to carry on the practice in a consistent way as a monk or a nun, because you have a very supportive environment all of the time, and you have reflection, which is invaluable. What I mean by that, you have people who are calm, who are still, and you can be, we get all caught up in our preferences, and then we meet someone who's just not buying into our trip. And what we get is then just that reflection of, you know, our preferences, our desires, our obsessions. And that, unfortunately, we don't usually encounter in the larger marketplace. And so that's extremely valuable. However, it's not the only way to do it. Wisdom, you know, isn't the exclusive right of monastics by any means. But it seems to, well, from personal experience, I mean, I find it a wonderful way to live. You know? I love being a monk. And I just, strange set of circumstances, I ended up in Thailand and I met a Westerner, a monk, who turned out to be Ajahn Sumedho, who offered me what by then I knew I needed. I needed a structure, I needed some people to help me, to restrain me. And that's what monasticism offered. And because it's open-ended, there's no lifetime vows, I thought, well, took his suggestion and tried it. And then I took a real close, critical look at what life entailed. And I didn't find anything of importance that wasn't beneficial. You know, there were some silly things, unimportant things that I didn't like, but nothing that was really of value that I could say wasn't correct, wouldn't be helpful, wouldn't be conducive to developing compassion and wisdom. It's evolving.
What was the question?
Would you repeat your question?
If you repeat it, then you can hear.
How are women evolving in the Theravadin tradition?
Monastic community.
Oh, I see how. Ah, gotcha. It's not that sensitive, huh? It's not, the mic isn't that sensitive, huh? Oh, I see. The senior nuns are, the four senior nuns are not terribly senior, relatively speaking. They've been nuns for 6 years. And they're just beginning. Usually for a monk, he doesn't start assuming teaching responsibilities until he's been around for at least 7 years. And then just begins to assume teaching responsibilities. But what happens in a monastic community where there's monks and nuns is similar to what happens in almost any community. People tend to gravitate to what they can, what they like to do and what they can do. And so there's, particularly at the large new monastery, Amaravati, there's so much going on that the monks and the nuns find themselves doing what they can do. And it's quite varied. One of the nuns is just very efficient in as a secretary, as an organizer. And so she does that. I mean, she runs the monastery on one level, you know, the daily taking care of the guests and so on. And one of the nuns is an excellent mason. And I found out that she's been taking lessons from one of the monks in welding, you know, in her spare time. And, you know. So, I mean, it's quite varied. I think as things evolve, the nuns will probably have their own. Ajahn Sumedho has mentioned it. Is this being taped? As long as they don't find out about it, it's all right. They'll probably, there's one of the branch monasteries is would be quite suitable as kind of like a testing ground to have the nuns, at least some of them, to go and be responsible for it. And that will probably happen. But it's evolving. I mean, it takes a while for maturity to come. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Are there bhikkhunis there?
No.
Are there going to be? Is that something that they have to do?
Difficult in the Theravadan tradition. Difficult. Oh, okay. A bhikkhuni is the equivalent of a bhikkhu, a monk. One who has higher ordination. A monk has 227 formal rules. And a bhikkhuni, the tradition died out, you know, 1500 years ago at least.
Yeah. Has there been any thought of, I mean, there are places where the bhikkhuni order did not die out, Korea, China.
Yeah.
Had there been any thought of bringing a legitimate ordination in from one of those countries?
We've thought about it. There's a way that we could do it, is by, because we've had some contact with Master Hua in California, and he has about 50 bhikkhunis, to send some of our nuns to him and have them train and prepare for bhikkhuni ordination. But it wasn't until last year with the new monastery that we had a suitable place for bhikkhunis to live. So, you need that, or they wouldn't be able to keep their discipline. And that would be disastrous. But when, I don't know if that will happen. And one of the necessary ingredients is you have to have nuns who want to become bhikkhunis. Right now they have higher ordination as dasa sila. So that means they keep 10 of the major rules with quite an elaborate discipline, monastic etiquette, outside of that formal structure. And when, I don't know if it was seriously suggested, but when there was kind of like a rumor at one time floating around that maybe we would do that, none of the nuns seemed to be terribly keen on going to Master Hua. So you need that first.
There is one woman in Thailand who a year ago was ordained. She went to China and came back. So there is one Bhikkhuni in Thailand.
She's not acknowledged, though.
What?
She's not really recognized. Most of the from what I understand anyway, most of the bhikkhus in Thailand do not honor that.
Where is she staying?
I'm not sure where she is in Thailand.
It would be almost impossible for a bhikkhuni to live on her own. She'd be breaking her rules. And if you don't keep your discipline, then you're not a bhikkhuni. You have to have the right situation. You know, you can't just decide that you want to be a bhikkhuni and go out and take higher ordination. And unless you're going to stay in that monastery with other bhikkhunis, you can't travel alone. Yeah, fine. I mean, that's one of the major rules with the bhikkhuni. They have to stay in a monastery where there are monks.
It depends on which tradition you're talking
right.
about.
Right, but the Theravadan tradition, right? Yeah. I mean, it would be better if someone was so inclined to take that higher ordination than to stay in Taiwan or where they took such an ordination. Or go and practice live with Master Hua in California.
Andrei, I think there's time for one more question.
Before the popcorn comes. Yes. Not very much in our particular tradition, although that is a little bit more time in some of the monasteries, and last few months at the new monastery, we had a very famous scholar monk staying there, and he taught Pali, the Abhidhamma, and the scriptures, part of the Theravadan scriptures, and taught classes every day. But we don't, it's not. It's something that it was voluntary. You didn't have to do it, and so those that were interested took advantage of that situation. In the other monasteries, we usually have periods where we give readings from, usually every day, from the scriptures, and of course there's talks. Five times a week, something like that. Often.
So, to me, practice is like this incredibly deep and rich gold mine. You know, and the more you go into it, it's like you get closer and closer to the main vein, and it just gets. It has not lost its. Not only hasn't been lost, the vitality of it and the interest and the understanding keeps growing the more we practice. And it's what's tremendously inspiring to me about it.
you know, the depth. Because usually in our lives we just, often we get satisfied, you know, that we have a little bit of understanding or a little bit of proficiency in whatever, and that's enough. You know, we kind of just coast along on that. But to really have a feeling of what it's possible in ourselves, it's not... it's like our minds actually have the potential to become Buddha. Isn't that amazing? And it's there, you know, and it takes practice, it takes the effort, but to see that that potential isn't, the potential is not something we get, it's not outside, it is in the nature of the mind. And so to realize that then opens up these vast possibilities. And it's wonderful.
I'm glad that you you mentioned that in the outside world, suspending noting may be an option, and I presume that there are other instructions that you've given us that we may be able to suspend. Like, thank you. reflecting and so forth. Could you give some new instructions?
The reason that I said that it might be useful to suspend noting was a memory of the time when Mahasi Sayadaw was visiting the United States and leading a retreat in Yucca Valley at our invitation. And somebody asked him about being mindful in daily life, and it went through the translator. And the answer back was, "Oh, don't bother about that. It doesn't matter, or you can't do that," or something like that. And there was a sort of stunned silence in the room. But what I gather he meant, what was coming through, you know, translation and retranslation, was I think he thought the question was about a very particular microscopic awareness that the noting helps. The noting does help it quite a lot. And he was saying that that is not appropriate. If you're in surgery, you know, it's not the time to be doing that. And yet there's certainly a sense of presence and groundedness and always a sense of self-awareness, which is valuable. I don't know that there are any instructions particularly for that. One of the basic reference points is the body, is to know what the body is doing, to know what is happening. Because you don't have to grope for a vague or subtle object. You can just feel your feet against the ground, or your hands touching, or an act of movement. And actually to be inside it and feeling it can make you drop down from being caught in a train of thought, you know, that is just spinning you round and round. And so a lot of the practice seems to involve being able to touch base in that way, just to come back to the body, to feel it, you know, to feel it. And to have very simple experiences without a lot of interpretation, even if it's only for a few scattered moments here and there, to feel your body, to touch something, to taste something, to actually hear without liking and disliking, even just for a moment, and to not neglect the value of those moments. Sometimes when people leave intensive practice situation, they think in large periods of time in terms of mindfulness. You know, it took a month to settle in, and then there was a month that things were quite continuous, and then the last month, you know, was was more restless or more anticipation or something like that. And sometimes with that idea in the mind, a single moment of mindfulness in a 24-hour day seems like nothing. You know, it seems like you might as well not bother if it's only going to be a few moments. But actually my experience has been that those few moments are very powerful. And so a good thing to do is not to neglect the little moments when you can just stop and be present in a very easy way. You know, not trying for a very subtle or particular state, just to now, I'm now. And when I was in nursing school, which I did for a couple of years, I used to find myself sometimes racing down the corridor of a hospital with, you know, this thing to do and that thing to do and that thing to do, and all of them going through my mind at once. And I wasn't getting anything done because I would kind of, you know, I would be bouncing back and forth between all of them. And I found if I could just stop for one moment and just feel my feet against the ground and start to do one thing at a time, I actually could get things done. The value of those moments is that they break the momentum. Is that when the momentum gets very strong and your mind is racing and your body is full of tension, you want more tension actually. That's what starts happening, is that the mind craves more stimulation to cover over the uncomfortable feeling. And so you want more activity and more things to do and more talking and more something. And so there's a large amount of craving to go outward and to get busier and faster.